Let's start with a question. What did you do to deserve the worst punishment you received as a child? Now, I realize not all punishments are deserved. I'm not trying to go dark here. I just want to know about the dumb stuff you did as a kid that got you a whooping.
The last whooping I got was for blatantly disobeying Mama. There was a cat up in our attic, and I wanted to go up there and check it out. And she told me no. Well, dummy me, I went up there anyway, and I'm thinking that she could hear me going across the attic. So I come back down. Well, it gets better. But anyway, the story gets funny. One fun thing. Okay, anyway, so I come back down, I get in trouble. Well, she goes and gets the belt. Dummy me, and Brenda will tell you, dummy, I ran from her. I was running all over the house. I go into the bathroom, get up on top of the side of the bathtub, and she's whooping my legs. So that was my last one, and I was 10 years old.
I can imagine Macy. All right. Huh? I'll imagine Macy then. She's 11. Alicia, did I see your hand up?
You just saw my face.
Okay. I thought you were sitting next to your mom. I kind of wanted to. Talking back.
I'm just talking back. Terrible.
Doggone it.
Well, I had some electricity at our house when I was about 12 years old, maybe a little younger. And we weren't supposed to go out and play with the lever in the box outside because it would shock us and kill us. So we were told. Well, we did. And my mother said, I'm going to tell your daddy when he gets home. And I laid under that bed all day long, hiding. Daddy come home and nothing was even mentioned about it. But I don't remember. I know I've had spankings. I remember giving a lot.
I'm sure I received something.
I remember my dad used to give me big whoopings, which was when I was not really in trouble. If I had played a joke on him or something, he'd put me on his lap and go with my stomach down, and he'd go one, two. And then on three, I would roll off his lap and he would hit his thigh and pretend like it hurt more than anything. Oh, one time I got a big hardback book, like an Aladdin book or something, and I stuffed it in the back of my pants and then intentionally asked for a big whooping and didn't roll off, and he hit the book and acted the same way. All right. Well, we're in Deuteronomy. We started this 6-week series last week. And so I want to begin by remembering the design of the whole book. We're going to talk about punishment, the punishment that Israel receives this morning. We begin Deuteronomy with the wilderness prologue, the first 4 chapters. A few of you probably chose to read that this last week. And then you have the 10 commandments. And I have written down the 10 commandments in chapter 10. It's in chapter 5. Followed by blocks of laws that address each of the 10 commandments in sequence. The commands then end with the promise of blessing and curse for obedience and disobedience. And then an epilogue where Moses gets his affairs in order before he goes up on the mountain and dies. So this morning, we're just going to focus on chapters 1 through 4, the wilderness prologue. One of the homework ideas last week was to read through these 4 chapters. So we're going to tease this out in a little more detail. These chapters are one long speech from Moses to the people of Israel, reminding them of a few selected events from their time in the 40 years in the wilderness. So he begins with the point where God told them it was time to leave Sinai. They spend about a year at Sinai getting the commands and building the tabernacle. And then when it's time to leave, they don't get very far before Moses and the people appoint a system of leaders. He appoints people over tens, over 50s, over hundreds, over thousands. And Once they're organized, they make their way to the Promised Land. They make a beeline straight to the Promised Land. It takes them like 11 days, I think, something like that, to get there. And when they get there, what do? Do you remember the story?
They send spies in.
They say, you go spy out the land, scope it out. And when the spies come back, what is their report? Is it a good land or a bad land? It's a good land. It's a good, bountiful land. But 10 of the spies say what? We can't do it. We're not going to be able to take it. Because there are giants in the land. So we're not going to be able to take the land. It's good, but it's impossible. And God punishes them for their unfaith by having them wander around Mount Seir for the next 38 years. So a year at Mount Sinai, a little bit of travel on either side of Mount Sinai, wandering in the wilderness. So they're in the wilderness for a total of 40 years. But they wander around Mount Seir for about 38 years. Now we fast forward. So if you're in Deuteronomy, you're in chapter 1, or actually you're in chapter 2. You have verse 1 of chapter 2. We turned and journeyed into the wilderness in the direction of the Red Sea, as the Lord told me, and for many days we traveled around Mount Seir. If you're the kind of person who takes notes in your Bible, I would put an arrow right in between verse 1 and verse 2 that says 38 years go by. Between verse 1 and verse 2, you have a break of 38 years. Because in verse 2, it says, then the Lord said to me, okay, you've been traveling around this mountain country long enough. It's time to go to the Promised Land. So, they begin to make their way toward the Promised Land. They start at Mount Seir. Mount Seir is land that belongs to the people of Esau, the descendants of Esau. And then they pass through the land of Moab. The Moabites are the descendants of Lot. Who is Lot? Anybody remember? Abraham's nephew. Okay, and there's a very shady story that happens at the end of Genesis 19, where we find out that some of his descendants are the Moabites. And God says, you're not allowed to have any of the Moabites' land. I gave that to them, and I keep my word. And also, there's a little parenthetical in verse 10 and following that formerly there used to be giants living in the land that is now belongs to the Moabites, but God disposed of them, and now the Moabites live there, but you can't have any. Then they go by the land of Ammon. Ammon is also the descendants of Lot, through a different child. And they also had giants in the land, but God disposed of them. And you're not allowed to have any of the Ammonite land because God gave it to them and God keeps his word. Then they come to the far side of the Jordan, the east side of the Jordan River, and they have two battles with two kings named Sihon and Og. I always want to say Og, but it's pronounced Og. Sihon is known to us only from this battle. He refuses to let the Israelites have safe passage through his land, and he comes out to fight them. And God gives them victory over Sihon and his people, Sihon. The other king, Og, is also known to us only from this battle. And it's a similar story. He won't let the people pass through his land, so they go to battle. God gives them victory over Og. What we also know about Og is, does anybody know the fun fact about him? Do you remember from reading this? He's a giant. He's bigger than Goliath is. We have the dimensions of his bed. It's 13 feet long, 6.5 feet wide. He's an enormous guy. He is one of the Rephaim, the giants of old. So they dispose of these. So we also think, by the way, that Sihon is probably also a giant. It never actually says that, but that's my kind of working assumption. And then we come to chapter 4, where Moses pauses to remind the people who God is and don't commit idolatry against him. It is the crescendo of this one long speech. All right, how are we doing? appointing the leaders, spying out the land, punishment by wandering, and then a series of passing through different people's land on their way to the promised land. Now, the prologue in chapters 1 through 4 is not extra. It's not something that's just tacked onto the beginning just to kind of give, I don't know, some background. The prologue is essential. The role of the prologue is to frame everything that comes after it in a certain light. And what we're going to read in chapters 5 through 26 is this collection of laws about how to live in the land. And yet, I think Deuteronomy is doing something even more than just, here are a bunch of laws that you need to follow once you cross this river. So to help us understand what Deuteronomy is doing, we need to pay close attention to the prologue, and we need to know some things about the land, about the relationship between God and Israel and the land. So here are a few things we need to know that I think will be helpful. First of all, the Bible portrays the promised land as a new Garden of Eden. What do we remember about the Garden of Eden? What can you tell me about it? Pure, beautiful, sinless.
Tree of life.
Okay, you got the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Innocence.
Innocence. There's innocence. Okay. The garden is a place where God and humans dwell together. It is a place of blessing and flourishing because it's only after the curse, it's only in the curse that God says, from now on, by the sweat of your brow, you will have bread. Before that, apparently, you have bread without the sweat of your brow. The garden is also the source of life for all of creation. Out of the garden flows a river that splits and becomes the four great rivers of the earth. The Nile, the Euphrates, the Gihon, which is the spring in Jerusalem, and the Tigris, I think. The idea is that all the great civilizations drink the water that ultimately is a gift from Eden. Eden is a place where heaven and earth overlap. That's what Eden is. It is heaven on earth. The promised land, which is the land of Israel, the land of Judah, the land of Canaan, is described in various places as a garden. And that's very intentional. So I'll show you a few examples. One is in Genesis 13. Lot lifted up his eyes and he saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. The Jordan Valley, if you go there today, is absolutely desolate. It is desert. This is where the Dead Sea is. But Genesis remembers a time when this land was lush and green. But then this was before God destroyed Sodom. Apparently the destruction of Sodom salted the earth. Is there anything to do with the destruction of Sodom and salt? Do those things go together? Okay. It's the salting of the earth, so nothing can grow. Another example, in Isaiah 51, this is after the people return from exile. The Lord comforts Zion. He comforts all her waste places and makes her wilderness like Eden. Her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness will be found in her, thanksgiving and the voice of song. So Isaiah anticipates a time when God will restore the land to its former Eden-like condition. Ezekiel does something similar. They will say, this land that was desolate has become like the Garden of Eden, and the waste and desolate and ruined cities are now fortified and inhabited. So there are a few places, we could look at others, but there are a few places where the promised land is described like it's the Garden of Eden. Now think about this. When the spies go into the land, they come back, and what is their report? You've already said it. It's a good land. It's a beautiful land. And what do they bring back with them as proof of the goodness?
Grapes,
which is a kind of fruit. They bring back fruit. Interesting. They go into the garden land and they take some fruit. Can we think of any other stories where people take fruit in a garden? And what happens when they take fruit in the garden?
Not good.
They're banished. What happens when the spies take the fruit in the garden? Banished. They're banished. They have to live in the wilderness. They actually have to die in the wilderness. Except for those who have faith. So the point, my only point in all of this, is that the promised land is not just this parcel of land the size of New Jersey that was promised to Abraham. It has symbolic significance. It is described as a new Garden of Eden, which means that entering the land corresponds to re-entering Eden. Crossing the Jordan by conquest is not just about staking their claim to a piece of real estate. Taking the land has cosmic significance. Because if the land is a new Eden, then entering it is like a reversal of the curse. This is the end of the curse of Genesis 3. Or it has the potential to be the end of the curse of Genesis 3. It's a reversal of banishment. God wants Israel to be a bunch of new Adams and Eves living in a new garden, tilling and keeping it once again. The land is going to be a place where heaven and earth overlap. And that's especially true of what particular place in Israel? Where do heaven and earth overlap in particular?
Jerusalem.
Because what's in Jerusalem? The temple. The temple is the place where heaven and earth overlap. So Mount Zion is the place where heaven and earth overlap. So this is like, it's like the inner sanctuary of the garden is the temple. Also, the Torah, the five books of the Bible, which are a group, they go together. It begins with banishment from the garden, and it ends with people poised to re-enter the garden. You have Genesis 1 and 2, where God makes everything. That's the setup. And then very quickly, the people are banished. And God's desire is for the humans to somehow be allowed back into Eden, or for Eden to come to them so that God and humans can be together again. And that's imaged really robustly in the tabernacle. But that's a whole other study. And then Deuteronomy contains these speeches that are given on the day before they re-enter the land. How are we doing?
Good.
Are we tracking so far? All right. What that means is that Deuteronomy is a manual for life in Eden. If you want to live in the land, here's how you do it. Now, if you have a Bible open, skip over with me to chapter 28. And someone, if you would, read for me verses 1 through 6 with gusto and excitement, if you would, please.
Rick's got the voice.
Rick, you've been nominated.
Okay. Then it shall be when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, and you possess it and live in it, that you shall take some of the first of all the produce of the ground, which you shall bring in from your land that the Lord your God gives you, and you shall put it in the basket and go to the place where the Lord your God chooses to establish his name. And you shall go to the priest who is in the office at that time and say to him, I declare this day
to
the Lord.
No, you're in chapter 26. 28.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So they started so similar, it took me a while to decide that, wait a minute, I think you're not reading
that.
Okay, let's try it again.
Chapter 28.
Chapter 28.
1-6.
1-6.
Now it shall be, if you will diligently obey the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments, which I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you, if you will obey the Lord your God. Blessed shall you be in the city, and blessed shall you be in the country. Blessed shall be the offspring of your body, and the produce of your ground, and the offspring of your beasts, the increase of your herd, and the young of your flock. Blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed shall you be when you go out.
Sounds kind of like Eden, doesn't it? If they will live according to the commands, then they will enjoy the blessings of Eden. Abundance, flourishing. Deuteronomy is designed to create a heaven on earth society. It's meant to shape us into the kinds of people who live like we're in the garden.
It's motivation.
So that raises the question, how is Eden different from the world as we experience it? What differences can you think of between Eden and our world?
No sin at first.
No sin? Balance. How about there's enough food?
Abundant peace.
Peace.
Face to face with God.
Face to face with God. So, to help us see what Deuteronomy is doing, we need to know a little bit about the land. Deuteronomy is about people who are about to enter the land. It's a manual for how to live like you're in the garden. We also need to take a close look at the prologue in the time that we have left. There are three features that I want you to notice. First of all, is the appointment of leaders. So look at chapter 1. Verse 13. Moses is recounting when they did this. He said, Choose for your tribes wise, understanding, and experienced men, and I will appoint them as your heads. And you answered me, the thing you've spoken is good for us to do. So I took the heads of your tribes, wise and experienced men, and set them as heads over you, commanders of thousands, commanders of hundreds, commanders of fifties, commanders of tens, and officers throughout your tribes. And I charged your judges at that time, hear the cases between your brothers and judge righteously between a man and his brother or the alien who is with him. You shall not be partial in judgment. You shall hear the small and the great alike. You shall not be intimidated by anyone, for the judgment is God's. And the case that's too hard for you, you bring it to me and I will hear it. And I commanded you at that time all the things that you should do. So apparently, when they come into the Eden land and they no longer have Moses, they're going to need judges who understand and interpret and enforce the 10 words, the 10 commandments, and all of their sub-commandments. And so it's important that these men be full of wisdom and that they not be subject to bribery. What this tells us is that life in Eden will not be possible without humans who are versed in the sacred writings, which teach us good and evil. Deuteronomy provides the knowledge of good and evil on God's terms, not on our terms. Also, life in Eden is not going to be mechanical, black and white. There are going to be times where judgment calls are needed. And God invites humans into the act of decision making with the aim that humans will ultimately further the peace and the shalom of the land as they lean on and are interpreting the Ten Commandments. So that's one thing we need to notice in the prologue. Another thing we want to think about is the spies and rebellion, the story of the spies and rebellion. In chapter 1, verse 19, all the way through the end of the chapter, this whole sequence is retold. Why is it important for framing Deuteronomy? Why is it before we read all these commands, we need to be reminded of this episode that landed us in the wilderness for 40 years?
We're supposed to obey God.
We're supposed to obey God. So it shows the seriousness when he says, obey me or it's not going to go well.
It shows lack of faith.
It also, yeah, we'll talk about lack of faith in a minute. The spies' evaluation of the land is good. And so if the land is good, then the God who's giving it is good. It's unfaith that kept them in the wilderness all this time. And there is a point in verse 41, after they've been sentenced to wander, they say, oh, no, we'll go, we'll go. And they go into the land and they try to conquer it. And what happens? They're soundly defeated. They're chased back into the wilderness. The land has to be received as a gift. The land has to be an act of grace. They cannot take it on their own terms. And then the other thing that just, we can't just not talk about it, is there are so many giants in these first three chapters, especially chapters 2 and 3. You have the promised land, which is full of giants. We can't take it because it's so full of giants. You have the land of Moab that used to be full of giants. You have the land of Ammon, which was once full of giants. The Israelites defeat the giant king, Og. And I think we're supposed to gather that Sihon was also a giant. So, what is the deal with all of the giants in chapters 2 and 3? This isn't a recurring feature in the rest of the Bible. It's not like you just come across giants on every page. So what's going on here? The best work that I have seen on this question comes from Michael Heiser in his book, The Unseen Realm. So if you're interested in this beyond what I have time to say, go read Heiser. We don't have time to go into detail, but here's the main idea. Here's the main idea. The giants are called by different names through these two chapters. They are called the sons of Anak, the Anakim. They are called Rephaim. They are called Zamzumim. They are called Emim. It's like there are different tribes of giants. And the thing is, they're not just really tall humans. If we think of them as just really tall humans, we're missing the point. They are mutants. They are half-breeds between humans and demons. Go read Genesis 6, 1 to 4. They are quasi, not divine, they're supernatural creature monsters. And the land is full of them. And they apparently have their own little tribes, the Emim, the Zamzumim, the Rephaim, the Anakim. And when we read Deuteronomy, it's like we're entering this world that's full of angels and demons and giants and monsters. And these giants are roaming the land that is going to serve as Eden. And so the first thing you're going to have to do when you cross the river is you're going to have to purge the land of this demonic influence. That's one of the things that's happening in the book of Joshua. Okay, Moses assures them the giants used to roam also in Moab and Ammon, but God has already done for those nations what he's going to do for Israel. Which brings us to faithfulness and rebellion. In Deuteronomy, this manual for how you're going to live in Eden, which really is a manual for how to make any land more Eden-like, Israel stands poised to re-enter the land, but they have to enter by faith and grace, not by force. They have to learn to trust God. And so Moses reminds them over and over and over in these four chapters how God has been faithful to them again and again and again these 40 years, despite their constant, persistent rebellion. They have been fickle. He has been faithful. So I'll throw up four specific passages. In the chapter 1, 9 to 13, that's the story of the appointment of the leaders. The reason they need leaders, Moses says, is that you have multiplied and you've become as numerous as the stars in the sky. Oh, can we think of any other time where Israel was said to be as numerous as the stars in the sky? Abraham. God promised Abraham, your descendants will become as numerous as the stars. And now Moses says, God has kept his promise. And you have multiplied greatly. In chapter 1, verse 26 to 31, that is how the Lord your God goes before you. He will fight for you just as he did in Egypt. That's in verse 30. And just as he fought for you in the wilderness, where you've seen how the Lord your God carried you as a man carries his son. So God has fought for you already. He will fight for you again. In chapter 2, 2 through 5, the wilderness years, you've been traveling through all this land and God gave this land to Esau. I'm not going to give any of this land to you. Why? Because God is faithful even to Esau. He's not just faithful to Israel, because it's not in his nature to be unfaithful. If he gave that land to Esau, it's his. And then in chapter 2, 30 and 31, that's when they defeat King Sihon. And God is going to give Sihon's land to them. And so he hardens the king's heart and makes him obstinate. Which, the heart of the king becoming hard, what does that remind us of? Pharaoh, it sounds like he's going to do what he did in Egypt. Okay, that's all we have time for. I hope that this has situated Deuteronomy 1 through 4 a little better for you. I hope that you're now ready to move in to the rest of the book. I wanted to ask what happened in your Lectio Divina of chapter 4. And we're going to come back to that in just a second. But here is some possibility for next week. Some things you might choose to do. One is to reread chapters 1 through 4, now that you have all of this in mind. Another possibility is to read Deuteronomy 5 through 6. We're going to talk about that next week. Or to do the Lectio Divina practice again, and there are the steps on chapters 5, verses 1 through 21. That's the Ten Commandments. So do Lectio Divina on the Ten Commandments. With that in mind, I want to come back and spend whatever time we have left with this. What happened for you in doing Lectio Divina on chapter 4 this week? If anyone decided to do it. Anybody read the Bible this week?
Not that.
We're going to spend the next five sermons in chapter 4. It is dense. It is full of wonderful things. All kinds of things that might catch your attention. So I would encourage you over the coming week, find some time to sit down with chapter 4 and just marinate in it. Just read it and enjoy it. His words are like honey to our lips.
Well, since you've described and explained a lot of it, I'm going to be a lot closer to being able to do that. But last week, I wasn't able to do that. I didn't get it.
I read it and then I listened to it because I'm on my phone. I can listen, so I did that. I read two different versions of the Bible of it.
My hope is that we come to appreciate Deuteronomy for what it is. Masterpiece. All right, that was the bell. Thank you, guys. Next week, we'll do chapters 5 and 6.